But if you really talk about family values, what does family values mean? Can you honestly tell me that it is a family value? A family value when a woman is forced back to work after giving birth 1 week after that birth? Is that a family value? Is it a family value when a parent cannot take care of a sick child and doesn't have the guarantee and the right to do that? Is it a family value? Talk about family values. When people think back about their lives, you know, what do you think about? You think about the vacation time you spent, moms and dads spent with their kids. And yet you've got millions of workers who have no paid vacation time at all. Those are real family values. And you're right. I intend to appropriate that language to really talk about the family values that matter to the American people.
A vow of poverty. Quoting here, the headline of the article, "Facing poverty, academics turn to sex work and sleeping in cars." There's nothing she would rather do than teach, but after supplementing her career with tutoring and proofreading, the university lecturer decided to go to remarkable lengths to make her career financially viable. She first opted for her side gig during a particularly rough patch several years ago, when her course load was suddenly cut in half and her income plunged, putting her on the brink of eviction. In my mind, I was like, "I've had one night stands. How bad could it be?" she said. And it wasn't that bad. The wry but weary-sounding middle-aged woman who lives in a large U.S. city asked to remain anonymous to protect her reputation. And she is an adjunct instructor, meaning that she's not a full-time faculty member at any one institution, and strings together a living by teaching individual courses, in her case, at multiple colleges. "I feel committed to being the person who's there to help millennials, the next generation, go on to become critical thinkers," she said, "and I'm really good at it, and I really like it. And it's heartbreaking to me that it doesn't pay what I feel like it should." Sex work is one of the more unusual ways that adjuncts have avoided living in poverty and perhaps even homelessness. A quarter of part-time college academics, many who are adjuncts, though it's not uncommon for adjuncts to work 40 hours a week or more, are said to be enrolled in public assistance programs such as Medicaid. They resort to food banks and Goodwill, and there is even an adjuncts cookbook, Google it, that shows how to turn items like beef scraps, chicken bones, and orange peel into meals. And then there are those who are either on the streets or teetering on the edge of losing stable housing. The Guardian has spoken to several such academics, including an adjunct living in a shack in North Miami, and another sleeping in her car in Silicon Valley. The adjunct who turned to sex work makes several thousand dollars per course and teaches about six per semester. She estimates that she puts in 60 hours a week, but she struggles to make her ends meet after paying $1,500 in monthly rent with student loans that, including interest, amount to a few hundred thousand dollars. Her income from teaching comes to $40,000 a year. That's significantly more than most adjuncts. A 2014 survey found that the median income for adjuncts is only $22,041 a year, whereas for a full-time faculty member, it's $47,500. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 223. We are covering what I'm referring to today as the vow of poverty. I want to thank you so much for being here. So I heard a senator once say, "Don't tell me what your priorities are. Show me your budget, and I will tell you what your priorities are." And it seems to me that probably the most important people in our society, well, one of those folks would be teachers, because that's who holds the future in their hands. My wife is an educator, and I know plenty of educators. My wife, too, went to college, and she got her master's degree, which was not cheap, and we took on all kinds of debt, and I'm not entirely sure it's something that she would have done had she and I not been together, because I worked several jobs while she was making that happen. We've been able to do something that a lot of folks haven't been able to do, putting our resources together and keeping our budget pretty quiet, pretty non-eventful, we've been able to pay those off. But it doesn't work out that way for everybody, especially if you have to take on several hundred thousand dollars in loans. See, we were lucky enough, we only had to take on 20 grand, probably, something in that neighborhood, which is still pretty insane, because it seems to me that if we've got money for things like tax cuts, if we've got things, money for things like war, we've got money for things like mass incarceration, those aren't really investments. We like to call them investments in protection and all this other stuff, but it's not. Teachers are what make us what we are. This is our intellectual infrastructure, and we need to see it that way. And this is an honest to goodness investment when we put money in the teachers. But we have said, one, we're not going to pay them enough. I hear it from my wife. I hear it from the people that she works with. Yeah, they're definitely not paid enough. And if you flip on the Fox News or right-wing radio or any of these, they'll tell you that those dang gum teachers, they're making too much. And those, you know, those teachers unions, they're just screwing the whole world. And it's just not the case. A lot of them are doing a very hard job that it seems to me is only getting harder. And we, as an American society, this is a largely an American problem. Of course, there are undeveloped or underdeveloped countries that deal with things like this. But as far as developed countries go, fairly certain that we're the last. We're the last one that treats our teachers like this. They do a hard job for not a lot of money. And they do it because they love it. And they, in doing that, unfortunately, take a vow of poverty. And then the rest of us who are okay with it, who just stand on the sidelines and let this stuff happen, or who even advocate for it like a lot of conservatives do, they end up becoming a part of the problem. I've talked about in recent shows how for a lot of conservatives, especially since Trump has become president, the amount of conservatives that see college as a necessary thing has dropped dramatically, something like 30 or 40 points among self-identified conservatives since Trump has become president. Because they say, well, you send the kids to school, they just become freaking liberals. Well, if they go to school and they get some knowledge and they end up becoming liberals, that doesn't make them evil. It just makes them educated, which isn't to say that if you're a conservative, you are uneducated. But if that's what an education does, is it turns you into a bleeding heart liberal, then let's educate people. Quoting again from the article here, we take kind of a vow of poverty to continue practicing our profession. This according to Deborah Lee Scott, who is working on a documentary about adjuncts. We do it because we're dedicated to scholarship, to learning, to our students. A quarter of part-time college academics are said to be enrolled in public assistance programs. Adjuncting has grown as funding for public universities has fallen by more than a quarter between 1990 and 2009. Private institutions also recognize that the allure of part-time professors, generally, they're cheaper than full-time staff. They don't receive benefits or support for their personal research, and their hours can be carefully limited so that they do not teach enough to qualify for health insurance, because we don't have national health insurance. This is why adjuncts have been called the fast food workers of the academic world. Among labor experts, adjuncting is defined as precarious employment, a growing category that includes tempting and sharing economy gigs such as driving for Uber. An American Sociological Association task force focusing on precarious academic jobs, meanwhile, has suggested that faculty employment is no longer a stable middle-class career. So even if you're not adjunct, it's no longer considered a middle-class career. Adjunct English professor Ellen James Penny and her husband live in a car with their two dogs. They've developed a system. Keep nothing on the dash, nothing on the floor, and you won't look like you're homeless. Don't dress like you're homeless either. Advertising online, she makes about $200 an hour for sex work. She sees clients only a handful of times during the semester and more often during the summer when classes end and she receives no income. I'm terrified that a student is going to come walking in, she said, and the financial concerns have not ceased. I constantly have tension in my neck from gritting my teeth all night. The story even goes into how if they live outside, sometimes these people who are teachers, educators, with degrees, end up having to use the restroom in a bucket. When Ella Tara James Penny finishes work, teaching English composition and critical thinking at San Jose University in Silicon Valley, her husband Jim picks her up. They have dinner, drive to a local church where Jim pitches a tent by the car, and sleeps with one of their rescue dogs. In the car, James Penny puts the car seats down and sleeps next to the dogs. And then she grades papers using a headlamp. James Penny, 54, has struggled with homelessness since 2007 when she began studying for her bachelor's degree. Jim, 64, used to be a trucker but cannot work due to a herniated disc. Ellen made $28,000 last year, a chunk of which goes to debt repayments. The remainder is not enough to afford the Silicon Valley rent. At night, instead of a toilet, they might use cups or plastic bags and baby wipes to get clean. They find restrooms and they have to take what they call a sink shower. I've been homeless before. I remember those. James Penny said, the couple keep their belongings in the back of the car and a roof container. All the while, they deal with the consequences of aging. James Penny has osteoporosis and he is in a space too small to even stand up. James Penny does not hide her situation from the class. If her students complain about the homeless people who sometimes come up to them on campus, she will say to her students, you're looking at someone who is homeless.
Taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society. And as society becomes more civilized, government, national and state and local, is called on to assume more obligations to its citizens. The privileges of membership in a civilized society have vastly increased in modern times. But I am afraid we have many who still do not recognize their advantages and want to avoid paying their dues.
So the word that we're hearing out of Washington, D.C. right now is that taxes need to be cut. My representative, Jamie Herrera Butler, is on board with that. Taxes need to be cut. Taxes are the problem. Taxes everywhere. I got a call from my dad this past week, who was a conservative. And he said to me, oh boy, how are things going with the biz? And I said, things are going great with the biz. And he goes, you're about to get a middle class tax cut. Oh, father, you are so young. You are so naive. But it was stunning to me to hear that. Because he's one of these folks that will tell you, right to your face, the government can do no right. And it should very likely be entirely abolished. Government bad, everything else good. But he believes that a middle class tax cut is coming. And that he and I are likely going to benefit from it. In this case, I say, follow the money. Who, for Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who are his biggest donors? Do they want me or you to have a tax cut? How about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader? Perhaps his gigantic multi-billionaire donors, maybe they would like for me and you to have a tax cut. No? Maybe they only want tax cuts from my dad. And maybe that's why he's happy, because it's not for me. How about Trump? And this is one of the things during the election where people said, one of the things I like about Trump is he can't be bought. He's got his own money. He's a billionaire. I don't know that he is a billionaire. I'm not even sure he has money. I have a sneaking suspicion that Trump might even be broke. And maybe that's why we're not seeing his tax cuts. His tax returns. Excuse me. The reason we're not seeing his tax returns may have something to do with Russia, but it might also have something to do with the fact that he's flat broke. So yeah, even Mr. Trump has donors. Even Mr. Trump, just like the rest of these guys, is effectively bought and paid for. So taking people's health care failed. The whole killing people thing, however, did not fail. Because thanks to their inaction on guns, some nutjob was able to kill a whole bunch of people in Vegas, which I know they've got to be excited about. So, failing at repealing healthcare, what's next up? Tax cuts. We need to cut the taxes. Oh, that's right. I almost forgot. If you've not been introduced to them already, I'd like to introduce you to them now, the Patriotic Millionaires. And this is a group that is saying, please, oh please, raise our taxes. One of the other stunning things that was said to me, because when I was speaking with my father, he just started going through this whole list of talking points and then said, no, we're not going to talk politics. And then he let it go. But one of the things he said to me is, poor people do not create jobs. Poor people do not create jobs. Poor people don't create jobs. Okay, fine. I will cop to that. Poor people aren't giving anyone jobs. Homeless people are not giving anyone jobs, clearly, right? They can't pay them a wage. They don't have businesses. But let me submit this to you. I grew up dirt poor. I was homeless sometimes. No place to live, sometimes not a lot of food to eat, but I was on welfare a lot of the time. The state paid for my education. The state paid for my housing. The state paid for my food. I grow up. I become a taxpayer. I begin contributing to the tax base. As time goes on, I eventually start a business and I begin creating jobs. True. I did not create the jobs when I was broke. No resources. There's economics working here. But I did once I got a leg up. I got help from the welfare state. And there's this whole thing now where these millionaires, they're willing to use the welfare state. And that's what they get. They want a gigantic tax cut. They want to operate inside of America. But they don't want to play by the rules. And they don't want to give any money to the, they don't want to pay into the tax base. And they don't want to have any responsibility. You know, they don't want to have any connection to the society in which they operate and make all their money. But they would very, very much like you to just give them a whole bunch of your money. And they don't want to pay anything to be here, to live here, to operate here. They don't want to pay anything because they're businesses and they're freaking creating jobs. And the tax breaks that are coming, they're not for me. They're not for you. They're for Trump. And they're for the Republicans in Congress. Quoting here from an article written by Amelie Ratliff in The Guardian. The headline, "I'm a millionaire and I don't need another tax break, Mr. Trump, at a time of staggering inequality. I can't believe the Congress and the Trump administration want to give me, Amelia, another tax break." The Republican Party unveiled their tax reform plan, which included the elimination of the federal estate tax. But as one of a small segment of people in the top 1% with enough wealth to someday pay the estate tax, I, reading from the article here, believe a tax on inherited wealth is completely reasonable and fair. Stepping outside the article here, the estate tax helps cut back on multi-generational wealth. It helps reduce dynasties. The idea that you are born to the right people and therefore you deserve to be rich is insane. Isn't everyone supposed to get rich by the sweat of their brow? Back to the article. "I grew up in Alabama, one of the poorest states in the country, in a wealthy family. We benefited from financial deregulation during the Reagan years, as well as prudent taxpayer-funded investments that ensured stability, prosperity, and economic growth. Delivered through decades of increased economic division and racial inequality, I believe today's wealth gap is poisoning our body politic. After the Second World War, between 1945 and 1975, we taxed wealthy people and invested in infrastructure, education, and middle-class opportunity. Veterans Administration mortgages, the GI Bill, and other debt-free college opportunities put millions of families, albeit mostly white, on the road to economic prosperity. Median income rose commensurately for all working people, secretaries and sanitation workers, as well as CEOs. In recent decades, though, we've seen tax cuts for wealthy folks and failed to make adequate public investments to ensure broad, shared prosperity. This has led to problems such as the deteriorating state of our public infrastructure and declining social mobility. What good will come from a generation of college students saddled with the average debt of $37,000? How can companies and their employees thrive when the average CEO salaries are over 300 times that of their average employees? Maintaining an estate tax is one of the few ways we can raise revenue without hurting low and middle class families. The estate tax is only paid by couples with over $11 million and individuals with $5.54 million. This is fewer than one out of every 500 households, despite the fact that on the campaign trail, Trump said, "We're going to cut the estate tax because it hurts family farms." No, it doesn't. It hurts multimillionaires, and that's it. My desire to retain the estate tax is not born out of charity or generosity. These levels of inequality undermine everything we care about. The Center for Economic Policy Research that predicts that even without abolishing the estate tax, the wealthiest 1% of Americans will claim half all private U.S. wealth in the next 20 years. Meanwhile, The assets of ordinary Americans are stagnating or eroding. Homeownership rates, a traditional measure of middle class well-being, have been steadily declining since 2005. The wealthiest 400 U.S. billionaires today have as much wealth as the bottom 62% of U.S. households combined. The wealthiest 20 U.S. individuals alone, a group small enough to fit in a Gulfstream 650 luxury jet, have as much wealth as the bottom half of U.S. households. So clearly, what these folks need is a tax cut.
A lot of our far right-wing friends like to worship Jesus as a god because that's a whole lot easier than having to follow his extremely liberal teachings. And Jesus, as far as we know, didn't care one bit about who believes in talking snakes. Jesus mentions talking snakes as often as he mentions gay people, premarital sex, and abortion, which is to say, never. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus does state his priorities in a parable. He talks about separating the flock, the sheep from the goats, and he thanks the sheep for feeding him, for welcoming him even though he was a stranger, clothing him when he was poor, taking care of him when he was sick, and caring for him when he was in prison. The goats, safe to assume he means the fake Christians, all say, well, Jesus, when were you poor and hungry and sick and in prison? And Christ replies, when you didn't do it for the least of my people, you didn't do it for me. And that's what Christianity was supposed to be about. Not calling the poor lazy, justifying torture, not fighting for tax cuts for the wealthiest Nazarenes, not asking lepers for a bigger copay, and not teaching kids to ignore science so they can believe in a talking snake. A more plausible theory is that literal creationism is Satan's nifty little plot to make Christians look very silly.
I bring up this point, and I play this John Fugelsang clip, because these are the folks that overwhelmingly brought us not just this House, not just this Senate, but also this president, under the belief that they were going to help regular working people. It's stunning to me that what they believe is going to come out of a bunch of billionaires is help for all of us. They seem to be forgetting the camel through the eye of the needle and that whole bit. But they were told continuously on the trail by someone who was not a woman that, hey, I've got no interest here. I'm here to help you. I'm already a billionaire. I don't even need to be here helping you people, but I am here helping you people.
Are you planning on putting your assets in a blind trust should you become president?
If I become president, I couldn't care less about my company. It's peanuts I want to make. I want to use that same up here, whatever it may be, to make America rich again and to make America great again. I have Ivanka and Eric and Don sitting there. Run the company, kids. Have a good time. I'm going to do it for America. Okay? So I would be willing to do it. I would put it in a blind trust. Well, I don't know if it's a blind trust if Ivanka, Don, and Eric run it, but is that a blind trust? I don't know. But I would probably have my children run it with my executives, and I wouldn't ever be involved because I wouldn't care about anything but our country. Anything.
Thank you, sir.
No, it's not a blind trust. And as a matter of fact, no part of that happened. He said that he did that, but a blind trust is exactly that. And see, in FDR, we've had wealthy presidents before. FDR actually put things in a blind trust. This president did not do that, and he's directly benefiting from being president. He's selling things with his name or the number 45 on it, you know, and he's selling it for unbelievable amounts of money. And nitwits are just buying this stuff up. And then he's spending money at his own golf courses. You know, the Secret Service has spent millions renting golf carts because whenever they go down to Florida with him, they got to roll around in golf carts, all these different golf carts, and protect him because he's the president. And they don't just get that stuff. They have to buy it. And it's bought with taxpayer dollars. But once again, come on. How is this guy helping the middle class? Give it to me.
He's good for the economy. He's for the terrorists not to come into our country. We don't need all these drugs coming into this country. Put the bill, the board up, Bill Irv. Trump, we're for him.
I'm trying to move away from coming down so hard on these people. And I'm trying to not be belittling to these folks. Because they're Americans too. Misinformed, miseducated, you know, misdirected, whatever. I want to know where you're at and why you're there. But my God, you people are not making it easy on me.
My name is Rhonda.
Rhonda?
And I'm on social media every day, all day, nonstop.
Yeah,
since
so am
last,
I.
Since last June.
I mean, not me. I mean,
no, pushing Trump. And one of the biggest things I can tell you that a lot of us are scared of is this voter fraud. We are, there's a lot of us that are out here saying that we go to vote, we're going to wear red. Our lives depend on this election. Our kids' futures depend on this election. And I will tell you, just for me, and I don't want this to happen, but I will tell you for me personally, if Hillary Clinton gets in, I myself, I'm ready for a revolution because we can't have her in.
Yeah, you don't say
but it. I'm just saying it. No, you know, I'm like Trump. You know, do I not speak for people here? Do I mind not saying the truth, guys? Come on.
Yeah, she was ready to kill people if she didn't, because she's on social media and she's an expert. And when they say revolution, when they say protection, what they're generally referring to is murder. But my God, her children's future. Of course, the fact that we're threatening war with North Korea right now, that's not a concern. You know, the fact that a woman might become president and might not get us in a nuclear holocaust, well, that's a real concern. And the rhetoric, the violent rhetoric, the clinging to guns, I don't particularly understand it, but I really, really would like to. And here's another thing I would really like to understand. The view on taxes. If you want to spend so much money on the military, if you want Trump to have all of these posh things, you know, and they do, they see him as a king and all the rest. And the flag that was created in Portland, Oregon, the one that says, in our America, all people are equal, love wins, Black Lives Matter, immigrants and refugees are welcome, so on and so forth. There's a conservative one of those floating around. And Love Wins is probably the biggest writing on the progressive version of that. And it's unfortunate I got to say the progressive version of it now. But the largest letters on that flag are Love Wins. And there's a conservative version now. And it says we celebrate Western values and all lives matter and all the dumb crap you hear, right? But instead of Love Wins, it's Trump Wins, which love is something that everybody feels, regardless of political affiliation. But Trump Wins. I mean, that's what's important. That's where a lot of these folks are at. And if you want Trump to have luxury and posh and everything gold, well, then you're going to have to start paying more taxes. If you want to have these gigantic military expeditions around the world where we kill people and blow things up, you're going to have to pay more money. If you want better schools, you're going to have to pay more money. If you want to quit driving on potholes, you're going to pay a little more money, you know, or you're going to have to ask the masters of the universe to pay more money. But there's this belief that if we reduce the amount of money that we take into the federal government, it will create more money, which is effectively like saying, if you quit your job, you're going to have so much money, it's going to be falling out your arse.
The opposition in this year has already imported into this campaign a very interesting thing because it's foreign. They have imported the propaganda technique invented by the dictators abroad. Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself. The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood, always a big one, for its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
Never a small falsehood, always a gigantic falsehood. You know, it's awesomeness, it's very nature. It will make people believe it. I know I'm not cool. So that's FDR, and I apologize about some of the presidential clips, especially some of the old ones from FDR and Eisenhower. I know the audio's not the best, and I clean them up the best I can, but they're so good because it shows you when I play these old clips, some of these like 60, 70, 80 years old, how little has changed with respect to the way we see each other, with respect to politics, with respect to the language that progressives use against conservatives and the things that are important to conservatives. And this idea in conservatism that if we simply cut taxes, it's going to unleash economic prosperity. There's just such the unleashing. And it never, ever happens. The largest part of this was born about 30 years ago, roughly 30 years ago. A little more than that. With Ronald Reagan. There's an article, an op-ed written in the Washington Post by Bruce Bartlett. If that name sounds familiar to you, good. You know a little bit about your history. If it does not sound familiar to you, Bruce Bartlett was a domestic policy advisor to President Ronald Reagan, St. Ronnie. And he's the author of The Benefit and the Burden, Tax Reform, Why We Need It and What It Will Take. Quoting from the article here, and by the way, this guy helped draft the GOP myth that cutting taxes will unleash prosperity. Quoting, 4 decades ago while working for Representative Jack Kent, I had a hand in creating the Republican tax myth. Of course, it didn't seem like a myth at the time. Taxes were rising rapidly because of inflation and bracket creep. The top marginal tax rate was 70%, and the economy seemed trapped in stagflation with no way out. By the time Ronald Reagan was president, the Republican tax gospel went something like this. The tax system has an enormously powerful effect on economic growth and employment. High taxes and tax rates were largely responsible for the stagflation of the 70s. Ronald Reagan's 1981 tax cut, which based a bill co-sponsored by Kemp and Senator William Roth that I helped design, unleashed the American economy and led to an abundance of growth. So these are the talking points. Based on this logic, tax cuts became the GOP's go-to solution for nearly every economic problem. Extravagant claims are made for every proposed tax cut. Recently, President Trump argued that our country and our economy cannot take off without the kind of tax reform that he proposes. Last week, Republican economist Art Laffer, he of the Laffer curve, said, if you cut the corporate tax rate to 15%, it will pay for itself many times over. This will bring in probably $1.5 trillion by itself. That's wishful thinking. So is most Republican rhetoric around tax cutting. In reality, there's no evidence that a tax cut would spur growth. Let me say something about the corporate tax rate, cutting it to 15%. So right now, it's effectively, it's almost nothing. But on the books, it's somewhere between 25 and 30%. But we have over 14,000 tax laws, most of those tax laws written for a specific company or a specific industry. And with all of those tax laws comes these corporate, and by the way, these laws get passed because people have the money to buy congressmen to get these tax laws passed. And they, in effect, pay nothing, absolutely nothing. And a lot of them, like GE, actually get millions of dollars back at the end of the year. So hold on. The tax cut, the corporate tax rate, isn't just cut. It's below zero. So how will dropping the number that's on the books even further unleash growth? So let's say they're paying, after they get all their tax rebates, let's say that they're paying effectively a negative 10%. Okay, right now the corporate tax rate is somewhere between 25 and 30. Well, let's just say it's 30 for number's sake, right? But they pay negative 10%. They get all those tax breaks and they've got accounts. I can get them all those good numbers. And so they're paying negative 10%. Well, if you take it from 30 to 15, which they're already not paying, it does drop it further. So right now, maybe they're taking home negative 10%. They'll begin taking home negative 25%. So we'll be paying corporations even more money. And this, we're told, is going to unleash economic prosperity. So most of these companies, the larger ones certainly, have a board of directors. And the purpose of the board of directors is once all that money comes in, and it's counted as profit, the board of directors will say where that money goes. And what those boards of directors have been saying in recent years, once again, since Ronald Reagan, is we should use that money to buy back our own stock, create a scarcity of our stock on the market, which will increase the value of the stock. Why are they doing that? What they could do is they could put the money back into their company. They could use it to pay better benefits. They could use it to pay higher wages or all kinds of other benefits. And then they could put those benefits on their tax forms and they can get even more money back, but they don't. So why don't the board of directors just go ahead and better the company? Like we're all being told that they will if we give them these gigantic tax cuts. Well, because a lot of these executives and CEOs are paid with stock. And when they use that money to buy back their company's own stock, which wasn't legal prior to Ronald Reagan, they use that money to buy back their company's own stock, therefore inflating the value of the stock. They're taking home even more money when they're taking home millions already. It's a myth, the idea that if we just give these gigantic corporations more money, they will spend it raising wages and creating jobs. And jobs are created by need, not because someone has a lot more money. It's created by need. I have a company. If I need extra help, I'm going to go hire somebody. If I ended up with $1 million tomorrow, but I could still run my company with just me and my wife, I'm not going to just hire people to hire people because I've got more money. It's not the reason I would hire somebody is because I need them. Quoting here, moreover, the GOP tax mythology usually leaves out other factors that also contributed to growth in the 1980s. First was the sharp reduction in interest rates by the Federal Reserve. The Fed funds rate fell by more than half. So they say, he cut taxes, and that's what just spurred gigantic economic growth during the time of Reagan. Actually, one of the things that helped was the Fed's fund rate fell by more than half, from about 19%. And I remember hearing about this from my father-in-law, saying that interest rates were over 20%. I've got like a 3-something percent rate on the value of my home, you know, on the loan that I have on my home. 19-20%. That dropped. That helped things out. It wasn't the tax cut. Reagan's defense buildup and highway construction programs also greatly increased the amount of money that the government was spending. This is textbook Keynesian economics. Then there was the simple bounce back from the recession of 81 and 82. Recoveries in the post-war era tended to be V-shaped. They were as sharp as the downturns that followed. The deeper the recession, the more robust the recovery. Finally, I'm not sure how many Republicans even know anymore that Reagan cut taxes on the rich, but he raised taxes on everyone else, and that seems to get lost. His last budget showed that as of 1988, the aggregate cumulative revenue loss from the 1981 tax cut was $264 billion, and legislated tax increases brought about half of that back. Sometimes you'll hear about the Tax Reform Act of 1986, but there's no evidence whatsoever showing a boost in growth from the 1986 Act. The economy remained on the same track with huge stock market crashes. Talking 87's Black Monday, 1989's Friday the 13th mini crash, and a recession beginning in 1990. The flip side of the tax cut mythology is the notion that tax increases are an economic disaster. Say, increase taxes and increase wages, it's going to destroy the... Hold on. The reason, in theory, every Republican in Congress voted against the tax increase proposed by Bill Clinton in 93 was because they believed it was going to kill the economy. Yet the 90s was the most prosperous decade in recent memory. At 37.3%, aggregate real GOP growth in the 1990s exceeded that of the 1980s.
You are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes.
Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then she is beyond, he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond.
There are very few of us, then, in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few.
We are told all the time that this president is Christian, his followers are Christian. They're simply following the Christian doctrine. The clip you just heard was from Ayn Rand. And when people go to work for Paul Ryan, they have to read an Ayn Rand novel. You'll hear Paul Ryan frequently cite Ayn Rand, who is an atheist, who does not believe in helping anybody. And although they will not say Ayn Rand as much as they say Jesus, it's pretty clear that the policies that they're shaping come from that. The September jobs numbers. I have the AP app on my phone because I'm a freaking news junkie. And every month, I get an alert about the jobs numbers. I get all kinds of other stuff too, but I get an alert about the jobs numbers as soon as it comes out, which is always like real early in the morning, you know, first of the next month. And I didn't get my job alert. And it took me a few days to realize that I didn't get the job alert, although it happens at the same time every month. And so I decided to go look it up. What? Why didn't I get the job numbers? Are the job numbers not out? Are the Department of Labor not releasing them? Ah, there it is. We lost 33,000 jobs in September when we were expected to gain 90,000. Now, the reason that's being given for this is that, well, the hurricanes. And sure, the hurricanes had an effect, but I believe that this is the beginning of a slide. And so what we were told every single month when the job numbers went up during the Obama administration, those numbers ain't real, they're fudging them. It was said during the 2012 election by Mitt Romney. It was said in the last election by Trump. It's been said over the last, you know, seven years that we've had continuous job gains every single month. Fake numbers. But the new administration comes in, and those numbers are happening on their watch now. Of course, it's a holdover, but it's happening on the Trump watch. And so they say, hey, those numbers are real now.
In the past, the president has referred to particular job reports as phony or totally fiction. Does the president believe that this jobs report was accurate and a fair way to measure the economy?
Yeah, I talked to the president prior to this, and he said, to quote him very clearly, they may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.
So if that was very real, then of course this is very real. And so we heard a little bit about the coming tax cuts. We're going to help you. Middle class tax cut. Poor people don't create jobs. We're going to help you. We're all in for you. It's all for you. And then nothing else. There's a whole lot of things happening with Puerto Rico that no one's talking about. Right now, the numbers are at several dozen that are dead. Depending on who you look at, the Mike, HuffPo, some of these other sources, they've got those numbers in the hundreds, in the mid hundreds, 300, 400, 500 people dead. And now people are beginning to die from waterborne diseases because they're drinking from streams to get their water. And of course, they don't have any sanitation. And we're all just looking at each other, fighting amongst ourselves. And still, if you can freaking believe it, talking about the NFL. And of course, that whole thing that's happening in Puerto Rico, well, come on now, that's just fake news.
After the mayor of San Juan criticized the government's Puerto Rican relief efforts, President Trump attacked her on Twitter, saying the mayor of San Juan, who was very complimentary only a few days ago, has now been told by the Democrats that you must be nasty to Trump. Oh, really, Donald? You bitch. Was she nasty to you? How nasty. Are you shaking? You want to go smoke a Virginia Slim until your hand stops moving? This isn't that complicated, man. It's hurricane relief. These people need help. You just did this for white people twice. Do the same thing. Go tell Melania to put on her flood heels, get some bottled water, some food, pack up some extra Atlanta Falcons Super Bowl t-shirts, and write them a check with our money, you cheap cracker. In 1 month, you've mishandled Puerto Rico, DACA, the NFL. It's like whenever anybody darker than your golf pants has a problem, you're thinking, how can I make this worse?
And the Democrats are doing their best to try to keep their news in the headlines, what they've got to say about these particular things. And they're pointing out what's happening in Puerto Rico, you know, and they're pointing out all these things that the president are doing that's a distraction. and the fight that they decided to pick this week. So the tax cuts that are coming are expected to take over the next 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, 8 to 10 years, $1.5 trillion out of the Treasury. Think about that. $1.5 trillion. $1 trillion is $1,000 million. So we're talking numbers that most people can't even fathom. So the Democrats said, let us help you get a better grasp on those numbers. Here are some things that you could do with $1.5 trillion. You could lift 3.2 million children out of poverty. You could make four-year college tuition free and guarantee every worker 12 weeks of annual paid family and medical leave at 66% of their monthly wages. This, according to the Century Foundation. You could give 4.4 million unemployed Americans a $15 an hour job. Now, the best way to put money into circulation, the best way to put money into the economy is to give it to regular working people such as myself, or people even, you know, on the lower economic ladder, like even below where I'm at. I'm middle class, thankfully. I'm middle class. But a lot of folks aren't. And if you give the money to them, they'll spend every bit of it, and that will definitely have an effect on the economy. 4.4 million people. You could, at $15 an hour, have a man dig a hole, have a man fill that hole. That will create an economic boom. That will create an economic activity. You go, yeah, but that's dumb work. Well, yeah, it is. And it's kind of stupid. I mean, you can have him do real work too. Have him pick up trash on the freeway. Who cares? Give him something. And then use that money for that. Because when the money is given to billionaires, millionaires, trillionaires, it's not going to be spent. You could double the earned income tax credit for working class families with kids. You could quadruple it for childless workers. Provide universal public daycare to all who want it, and build a national high-speed rail system. You could do both of those things with $1.5 trillion. According to the Economic Policy Institute, a program guaranteeing every American child access to high-quality health care or pre-kindergarten would cost roughly $90 billion in its first year of operation. Costs would go down once the child care infrastructure is put together, but let's say it would cost $900 billion to maintain it for the next decade. According to the Libertarian Cato Institute, the Libertarians, building a national high-speed rail system would cost about $500 billion. So there's your money right there. And every single one of my kids, when they were in daycare, that was $500 per month per kid. Yikes. For the last kid, it even went up to $600. That's money just for childcare. But this is a better way that you could spend the money, and people would have more money in their pockets. Here's a big one for me. You could end homelessness in the United States. Pass Trump's original infrastructure plan, and then give every single American about $90. Let me explain that one to you. The Department of Housing and Urban Development believes it could end homelessness with an additional $20 billion a year in funding. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump vowed to spend $1 trillion on rebuilding America's infrastructure, a proposal he likened to the public works projects pursued during the New Deal. With about $300 billion left after you ended homelessness, you could give every single American about $90. You ended homelessness and you gave everybody $90. It's a pretty good deal. Or just give it to millionaires.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of his children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Don't tell me what your priorities are. Show me your budget, and I will tell you what your priorities are. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the thing that was spearheaded by Elizabeth Warren, has what they refer to as an arbitration rule. This by David Dayan over at The Intercept, David Dayan and Ryan Grimm. Republican leaders are whipping to secure the votes to overturn the rule CFPB finalized in July, which would protect financial companies from class action lawsuits and deny customers a day in court. The rule is among the most consequential actions the CFPB has taken since it's founded. In a lot of contracts, companies such as Wells Fargo or Equifax will make you sign an arbitration agreement, meaning that you will go effectively, try to put this in the mildest terms, the simplest terms, that you don't get your day in court. You know, it has to be settled through arbitration. You don't get your day in court. It has to be settled through arbitration, which favors them, allows them to pay you out less, and then the cost of operations goes down for them because they don't have any accountability. And the Republicans are fighting right now, tooth and nail, to whip up the votes, to get rid of this rule that says that these companies cannot do this to you. And one of the companies that's fighting for this in a big way is Wells Fargo. And it is Equifax. And I remember hearing, dang gummit, just get Trump in there because he's not bought and paid for. And he doesn't have any connection to Goldman Sachs or any of these other companies. And then one of the first things he does as your president or president-elect is hire somebody from Goldman Sachs. And if that's not enough, hire somebody from Goldman Sachs to run the Treasury Department.
He promised when he was running for president that he would break the connection between Wall Street and this Congress. He said he was going to separate that from the government, no more revolving door. He wasn't going to do that sort of thing. And then what does he do? He turns around and picks a guy who had actually been one of the people who helped do all of those lousy mortgages that not only broke the economy, but broke millions of families. And then after the crash, a guy who turned around and bought a bank that then became infamous for how hard it squeezed families that had already been cheated, and was the foreclosure machine following that. The American people are furious over what Wall Street has done. They don't want somebody who's going to come in here and say, hey, let's help Wall Street. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's literally handing the keys to the Treasury over to a Wall Street banker who helped cause the crash.
And the stage is being set at this moment for that kind of a crash again. I think that the job loss numbers that we saw, even if it is due in part to the hurricanes, is not going to get better. Because if you look at what makes these hurricanes way worse, it's the contribution that we in the world are making to global climate change, especially here in America. Because we have Scott Pruitt in charge of the EPA, because we have decided that we don't want to do anything about clean air, anything about clean water or soil or any of the rest. We just want to continue poisoning it all because some corporation out there might make a little bit more money if we remove regulations. They might give us jobs. We just let them dump their crap into the air and the water. They might give us jobs. That's what we have decided collectively as a country. And of course, what we're really doing is mortgaging our future. I think that there are a fair number of conservatives that share the outrage that I have. They share the outrage with me. Yeah, they turned out and they voted for this guy. But I think in their hearts, they realize now, especially the way things are going sideways, even if they won't admit it openly, I think they realize now that they've been had. And for those of you that are conservative and are ready to have that conversation, I, for one, am ready to have it with you. And here's one of the things that we need to realize when discussing politics. First of all, it has to be discussed. My dad will get on the phone with me and he'll rattle off 30 talking points. And before I get to say word one, he'll go, "Nope, we're not going to talk politics. Move on." Now, wait a minute. We're both adults. We should be able to talk about this stuff. And if you're really so strong in your convictions, you shouldn't be worried about losing an argument. And it can't be a zero-sum game. When we talk about politics, we can't talk about it in an adversarial way. We really should try to understand our opponent, our counterpart. It shouldn't be, you say this, I say this, I win. That is not a discussion. That's a fight. Fights tend not to go anywhere. I think there's more that brings us together than divides us. But we all have our quiet little corners, our social circles, the internet, and all these other places that we go to get the hell away from each other. Because a lot of us have decided that all we want to live in is an echo chamber. And what's happening in our local and state and federal government right now is not in the best interest of better than 90% of us. Better than 90% of us. But there's no shortage of people who will defend what is happening in local government, in D.C., in these red states where they're just screwing their people. There's no shortage of people that are willing to absolutely outright defend that. And I think that they just don't understand it. But if we, and this is more and more becoming the theme of the show. I remember when I started this show, I just used to open this mic and ripping how stupid conservatives were. And I don't feel like that anymore. I don't want to be there. The more I listen, the more I talk, the more discussions I get into, the more I get to see my countrymen, my fellow Americans, as human beings with a lot of the same loves and interests that I have, the more and more I come away from that opinion, right? Get down off my damn soapbox, and I don't get to say, hey, I'm right all the time, you're wrong. I don't feel that way anymore. I feel like I'm really great on a lot of this stuff. But even with that, I feel like I have a long way to go. And part of that distance that I have to go is in understanding my fellow Americans and why they're there. I painted a pretty bleak picture in this last hour, but I did not do so to go, everything's bad, screw the world, set it all on fire, psh, give me the matches. I did it to say, here's the things that are happening around us, under our nose, in our faces, in our government, and we are responsible for all of it. Government is us. The government is a success or it is a failure based on us and our participation. And if we decide to not be a part of it, we are as culpable as those who are openly doing damage in our name in government. And it would be pretty easy to just, and I've done it before, point the fingers, damn you conservatives, y'all voted for the Trumpie. But it doesn't get us anywhere. And it only drives those folks away. It's an honest discussion that needs to happen. And I hope that what these shows do is they help chip away at that. I don't think my countrymen are stupid. And the number of them that are white supremacist can't be 50 or 60 or however tens of millions voted for Trump. I'm sure some people just looked past the whole racial thing. I'm really trying to understand here. Sure, a great big number of them are because they're marching in the streets screaming about Jews right now. But it can't be all of them. There's no way it's all of them. Maybe it's too many of them. But if that's the case, then that's the discussion that needs to happen. There's no better place than here. And there's no better time than now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here with me on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or on the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe or favorite so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.